afternoon. We're delighted to welcome you all to the hearing room, but we have some special guests from the Oregon High School. Would they please stand, please, the students. Well, welcome to our courtroom and the argument today. You may be seated, please. And Chetek Weyerhaeuser, students, would they stand? We're delighted to have you with us also. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited from all the schools across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the school comes, they are given materials ahead of time about the case, and they may engage in some activities related to the judicial system and the case. They come, they listen to an oral argument, and at the lunch hour, a justice of the court is assigned to meet with the students to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the cases we have heard today. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the deputy marshal will give you a summary. All right. Before I call the case, let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will now call 09AP524, Metropolitan Associates versus the City of Milwaukee. Arguing on behalf of the Metropolitan Associates is Robert L. Gordon, Attorney Gordon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice and members of the court. I am Robert Gordon of Michael Best and Friedrich, and with my partner Alan Markovitz and my partner Andrea Roschke, we represent Metropolitan Associates in this afternoon's argument. The court has invited us back for a second argument, presumably to focus on the issue addressed in our supplemental briefs, which involves whether there's a right to a jury trial in property tax challenges under Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution under the court's village food test. I'll focus exclusively on that issue unless the court's questions direct us back into the other issues in the case. Now, in reviewing the court's Article 1, Section 5 decision since village food, I think it's clear that the court has been presented with some rather demanding situations where the court really had to analogize a very modern statutory cause of action to a very different common law action that existed in 1848. In contrast, though, we believe we're presenting the court with a much simpler case today, because unlike a comparison between 19th century nuisance laws and 21st century environmental laws, or between rules of the road for horses and modern speeding laws for automobiles, the modern statutory cause of action in our case under Section 7437 is exactly the same action that existed in 1848 and for many years before that under English common law, which is an action against the local tax collector to recover property taxes that were paid involuntarily. So unlike the cases the court has had to consider previously since village food, the court, we think, will not have to grapple here with trying to decide whether the modern statute is really the counterpart of a very different historic common law cause of action. Here, the modern cause of action and the historic cause of action are the same, and there's an unbroken line of this court's decisions which confirm that they are the same. Now, as the party's supplemental briefs make clear, there's not a lot that we disagree on as to the questions the court asked us to address in our supplemental briefs. The four questions the court asked us essentially boil down to three issues. First, is there a constitutional right to a jury trial in an enhanced certiorari proceeding under amended 7047? Second, is there a constitutional right to a jury trial in a refund action under Section 7437. And third, essentially the Court's final three questions boil down to really one question, which is, what is the effect on this case if those two questions have different answers? Now, as to the first issue of the right to a trial under 7047, both sides easily agree that there is no possible right to a jury trial in an enhanced certiorari proceeding, and that's because that proceeding without question clearly traces back to common law certiorari reviews of administrative proceedings in which there never was even arguably a right to present new facts to a reviewing court or to a jury.
Counsel, I'd like to take you back to your introductory statement in regard to cases being exactly the same. Do you have cases to indicate that excessive valuation disputes were tried to juries in 1848 or before?
There, Justice Gableman.
Or before?
We have no direct evidence of an actual trial of an excessive assessment case to a jury in Wisconsin before 1848. But we think that under the village food test, that really doesn't matter because by definition in the village food test, what you're doing is trying to show that a modern cause of action.
Are you getting to the money had and received cause of action?
Money had and received cause of action. We clearly, there's no question in the cases that we found from before and after statehood, the money had and received action were.
Were the money had and received actions used as a vehicle to challenge excessive valuation?
And that is precisely, if we look to the trilogy of the three cases that this court decided that I think make clear, and which is why my introduction essentially said that unlike the harder cases, this one is clean. There's a trilogy of three cases from this court that make it clear that there's an unbroken chain from the common law action of money had and received being used for excessive tax assessments and the modern cause of action.
Excessive valuation cases?
Those were valuation cases in the sense that, and let me maybe answer the implied question in that. Valuation as distinguished from illegal assessment, I think is clear. If I can go through those three cases and respond to your asked and implied question. The first case where the court recognized the right was 1865, is Matheson versus Mazomanie. And once again, this is the elements of this cause of action are a property owner suing the tax collector under that common law theory of money had and received for a payment that was involuntarily made to the local tax collector. Now, in Matheson versus Mazomanie in 1865, that was before the first refund statute was ever enacted. The plaintiff sought a refund of tax involuntarily paid to the tax collector under that theory. This court permitted that suit to go forward. So by 1865, before there was a refund statute, this court had accepted
Did that case involve the taxpayer setting out an affidavit in regard to the valuation of
It was, which I think answers
and
the
court. At the time, I believe the statute on point would have required the tax-collecting entity to be bound by
precisely
the taxpayer's valuation. So how can you really say that that's a corollary to the modern excessive valuation challenge?
Because, in contrast to the city's argument, Justice Gableman, in fact, the assessor ignored the statute. In that case, there was the 1860 version of the statute. But it's essentially the same statute, if you trace it back, that the city has been citing that said the assessor has to follow the valuation. The assessor and the court mentioned it. It essentially ignored the statute. The statute said, you can't do this. The property owner had reported his property at a value of $1,000.
Right. And
the assessor raised
said
it to
$6,000. Right.
And even though the city, I believe, cites that in cases you could bring, I believe, some equitable action for that, Matheson was precisely an action for money had and received. The court said, assessor, you can't do this, but he brought it as an action for money had and received. So one, that decision I think is critical to answer, I think, the three implied questions that you're now asking. One, it makes clear that the money had and received action was allowed for tax refunds. Two, it's clearly an excessive assessment case because the taxpayer admitted that there was jurisdiction in the municipality to tax his property, but he just said this tax is too much. Three, the assessor ignored the statute completely, and despite the statute saying, you can't do this,
And that's why the Supreme Court called it an illegal tax.
It's illegal. They may have used illegal tax in those terms, but I think insofar as the city has been arguing, and Your Honor's question implies that the distinction between illegal and excessive assessments makes this defeats our argument under Village Food, because according to the city,
here's your opportunity to dissuade me or provide me with a different view.
But the point is, Justice Gableman, that I think the court's decision in Matheson, is the best way to persuade the court that the city is wrong, because in fact that statute was there. The assessor ignored it. The case was allowed to proceed under the money had and received theory. It was an excessive assessment case and not an illegal assessment case. And even though the split in the terms between excessive and illegal did not exist in those days, the court may have used the term illegal tax. But insofar as it's the city that's arguing that years later the legislature split the causes of action into illegal and excessive, so to the extent the court may have used the term illegal in Matheson, I'm not sure they did. But if they did, nevertheless, insofar as the city's argument is concerned, that was an excessive assessment case, because it was admitting jurisdiction and just saying we think that this tax is too high.
Counsel, you talk about involuntarily. I pay taxes all the time, not voluntarily, but I do it under coercion. If I don't, I may go to prison.
Well, this is the exact question, Madam Chief Justice, that the court addressed in the second of the trilogy of cases, the 1908 case, H.H. Stange. The court essentially said there, following up to the English history and the other things, that to be an involuntary payment for purposes of satisfying the element of the money had and received, and we certainly concede that as a critical element, we have to show an involuntary payment. But in A.H. Stange, this court specifically said, when you're dealing with a property tax, if there is a deadline by which the tax must be paid in order to avoid becoming delinquent, that is sufficient to be an involuntary payment. You do not need, and this is almost the court's exact words, you don't need to go into delinquency and sit there quietly and wait for the sheriff to come out and take your property away and foreclose it or take your personal property. It's sufficient for property tax payment that if you pay the tax in order to avoid going delinquent, that is an involuntary payment, specifically, as the court said in A.H. Stange, for the purpose of satisfying the involuntary payment element. And I think throughout
is there any property tax that has no limited time for payment? Is there any property tax that you're not delinquent at a particular time?
No, I think both personal in this state, personal property, real property, manufacturing property that's centrally assessed by the Department of Revenue, all in this state must be paid by the January 31st date at the earliest in order to avoid being delinquent. All property tax in this state, personal or real, is delinquent if not paid by January 31st.
So you get a jury trial in all of them?
Are you referring to all income and sales tax and everything else?
All the property taxes you made.
All property taxes, I think you could get a jury trial that are locally assessed. The one question might be what happens to, and it's a question not before this court, what would happen to manufacturing property in a tax appeals commission? And I think the answer to that would be there's one additional factor in there, which is the fact that it is centrally assessed by the Department of Revenue, which is essentially the sovereign. So you have sovereign immunity issues lurking there that the court would have to consider that thankfully it doesn't have to consider in this case. In a case like that, once again, the link, and I think the direct link from the trilogy of the court's cases from the common law action all the way back to the current refund action, is that the action, even under Old English common law, was always against the local tax assessor and not against the sovereign. So for all locally assessed property, I think it's clear that there would be a right to a jury trial. The extra consideration in a manufacturing case, because that's really a hybrid, it's paid to and collected by the local assessor, but it's centrally assessed by the sovereign. And since you presumably could not sue the sovereign in 1848 under a theory of money had and received, but could only sue local officials, that might be an extra reason why manufacturing cases before the Tax Appeals Commission, the manufacturers could not demand a jury. But that's not an issue in this case.
And what's the answer on income tax,
sales
tax?
I think the easy answer there, in addition to the sovereign immunity issue, and in addition to the fact that sales and use taxes sales and income taxes didn't exist in 1848, which would be another factor. I think there's a very clear dispositive factor, Justice Abrahamson, that's not at issue here. That's the fact that unlike the property tax area where you must, even under the current statute, pay the tax in order to litigate it and file a refund claim, for income and sales and I think virtually every other type of non-property tax that comes before our Tax Appeals Commission, there is no involuntary payment requirement. In Wisconsin, if you are litigating a case before the Tax Appeals Commission, income tax case or a sales tax case, you have several choices. You can deposit the amount involuntarily. You can make a voluntary deposit with the Department of Revenue to stop the running of interest. But that's voluntary. You can do it if you want to. Or you can choose not to pay it at all, let the interest accrue, and the Wisconsin statutes say the Department of Revenue cannot come in and forcibly collect from you as long as you're in the Tax Appeals Commission and you're continuing up on the chain of appeal. You could conceivably pay the tax and claim a refund, but once again, that would be a purely voluntary payment. So I think under the critical element of is the payment involuntary, which we concede is a very critical element of the money had and received cause of action, which links it to the modern 7437. I think if a taxpayer before the commission in an income and sales tax case were to come in and say, well, even if this court rules for us in this case, well, now I want a jury, I think the critical fact that there is no involuntary payment requirement would be a dispositive factor that would preclude a income or sales taxpayer from getting a jury in an income and sales tax case.
And when do you have to make a jury demand?
I think that it would be the same presuming 7437 survives, I think it would be within the context of whenever the jury trial would have to be made in any other circuit court action. You file, as the court held in Nankin, a 7437 action proceeds as if, as any other regular civil action. So certainly, if there is an obligation to make a jury demand by X date under the scheduling order in circuit court, you're bound by that the same as anywhere else. We certainly are not arguing, Justice Abrahamson, that somehow, if the court finds a jury trial right, that would give taxpayers a free get-out-of-jail card or a free chance to avoid the other limitations of 7437. I think clearly we are not arguing that you don't have to go to the board of review. We're not arguing you can file the claim late. We're not arguing you can pay the claim late. Certainly, just as under other Article 1, Section 5 cases, someone with an absolute right to a jury trial loses it if they don't make a timely jury demand, and everyone's okay with that, and this court is certainly okay with that. I think in the same vein, under Section 7437, if the court approves and finds that there is an Article 1, Section 5 right to a jury trial, and the legislature chooses to keep 7437 in place, which we would hope it would do, then I think it would be – certainly we are not arguing here that a taxpayer then could ignore and bypass all the other considerations in 7437 for maintaining and sustaining the suit. They would still have to go to the board of review if the statute requires it. They'd still have to pay on time. They'd still have to file a claim on time.
Would that right be retroactive to old cases that are already closed?
I would not think so, because again, consistent with the answer that I just gave to you, Justice Abrahamson, if a party did not file a claim by January 31st of the tax year, then I think that taxpayer has waived the right and could not come in later and say, well, now that I know I can get a jury trial, I want one. I think that would, you know, that's not certainly an issue in our case, but I think to answer the court's question, the logical extension of the previous answer I gave you would be that, no, I think that someone in that situation had the right to file the refund claim, the statute was there, and the fact that afterwards it turns out there's a right to a jury trial, I think that those cases would still remain closed.
Thank you. Justice Bradley.
Counsel, your opposing counsel cites to the case of State X. Rel. Ward versus the town, the assessors of the town of Delavan. And this is at page 5 of your opposing counsel's brief. And in that, on that page, there's discussion of the early statute, the statute that indicates that if a taxpayer made an affidavit as to the value of his property, then the assessor was required to accept it. Hyphen, amazingly. Isn't that amazing?
Mm. And with an exclamation point, Justice Bradley.
Pardon?
And with an exclamation point in his brief. Yeah,
that's right. Amazingly. And the case that is cited, the assessors of the town of Delavan, is cited for the premise that if the assessor failed to accept that value, then the taxpayer could bring a mandamus action against the assessor. Not a jury trial, a mandamus action. So how do you deal with the case cited by your opposing counsel
of
1853?
Yeah, certainly there were other options. The Ward case, which we obviously looked at, was in fact a mandamus action against the assessor, but the fact is nevertheless in our situation, the taxpayer, I don't know and I don't remember whether he was required to forcibly to pay it, I assume he wasn't, in the Delavan case. In our case, in the Matheson case, the assessor required the taxpayer to pay it. He was forcibly required to pay it. He then used the common law action of money had and received to collect it back. So I do not see why the fact that there might have been another option available to the taxpayer who could get into court before the sheriff came and forcibly took his property away, I don't think that at all defeats the significance of what this court did in Matheson, which is mostly to say, yes, you can file a action for money had and received in that situation. And because keep in mind, I think, Justice Bradley, the point of the city's argument in citing this case and its larger argument is, look, there can't, by definition, there can't have been a action for an excessive assessment. And this goes back to the city's, the only argument that we really dispute with the city is this illegal versus excessive argument. That's, as the court sees, that's really the only dispute between us. Did the action in the early days include excessive assessments or only illegal assessments? I think the city's point in inciting this case is to really say, look, there could not, by definition, have been an excessive assessment action in 1848 or before until the first refund statute was passed because, look, here's a statute saying the assessment that you put your affidavit in and you're done and nobody can do anything about it. So how can there have been an excessive assessment claim? You wrote your own assessment.
Unless it wasn't followed, of course.
Yeah, right. But I think the point of that is precisely, but that's the precise point, Justice Bradley. If it wasn't followed, and we would have been up here, but for the fact that Matheson's assessor decided to ignore the statute, I might have been up here arguing, gee, this might have happened, but in fact it did happen. That's exactly what did happen, which defeats, I think, the city's argument, which is essentially this case is cited just to say there couldn't have been an excessive assessment claim because there could never have been an excessive assessment. But here, in fact, we have the serendipity of having the case from 150 years ago where that very thing did happen.
Is there any evidence at all that there have been jury trials, actual jury trials in these tax cases?
Under the current statute?
Yeah.
I know there was one in Woolworth County many years ago, before Nankin and maybe even before the S.E. Johnson case in front of Judge Kennedy in Woolworth County that was tried to a jury. I know there's the case that in circuit court in Milwaukee that, and I don't know whether that actually went to trial, the one that we cited in our brief where the circuit judge had very briefly resolved this issue, and I'm not sure whether the city actually went to trial in that case. Mr. Michella would know. I know we have been involved in cases on both sides in front of both representing taxpayers and municipalities in which jury demands were made. Those cases, at least in our case, have all settled, so we have not gone to jury, but in both cases, when we were on both sides, the jury demand was allowed, and there was no contest to it. But other than I know that the one that we were not involved in, this goes back many years, the one in Walworth County, I know was a jury trial.
If this right to trial by jury were recognized, would it completely gum up these procedures? Would it completely gum up these procedures?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think that it's their valuation cases. And there's not that many. I think as the amicus state bar pointed out in its initial brief in the first round, there aren't that many of these. There are only the city of Milwaukee, I think, had given us a list of the number of cases. So there's not that many that would go to trial. It's a valuation case. There are so many different types of valuation cases that are routinely tried to juries. The most obvious is condemnation. Condemnation trials are routinely tried to jury, and it's a valuation issue. How much was this property worth on the day it was taken is exactly the same thing as how much was this property worth on January 1st in the tax assessment year. So I think for hundreds of years, we've routinely been trying condemnation cases. There's other property valuations, divorces, business separations, business valuation. Routinely, circuit court juries hear valuation cases. They hear from appraisers that testify, and they make a decision. And I think the one-word answer to the question would be look at the condemnation cases, and I come back to those because that's essentially the same case. Government entity versus private owner, how much was the property worth on a specific date? Appraiser testifies for one side, appraiser testifies for the other side. To the extent that there's legal issues involving uniformity and other legal issues come in, well, that's the same as anything else. The circuit judge decides the legal issues, but to the extent it's a pure valuation issue, which most of these cases are, except for the ones that end up filtering up to this court, the average garden variety valuation case could routinely be tried to a jury because we do that all the time in the condemnation.
If the court were to recognize a right to trial by jury under these circumstances, wouldn't that deprive the legislature of the ability to ever cut back on that right?
I think certainly. My red light is on, but I assume I can answer
Justice
Prosser's question.
Justice Prosser.
I think certainly it would, because that's what this court has said time and again in all the cases after Village Food and going back to Norval against Rice in 1853. If the right to a jury trial is found, the legislature can do nothing to stop that. The court said that in Norval. I think this court more recently in 1998, there's a case we cited that I can't think of the name of that said that. I think it would stop the legislature from taking away the right to a jury trial, but certainly as I couched in terms of my answer to the Chief Justice, we don't think that would take away the legislature's right to set conditions on when you have to pay and conditions precedent, going to the Board of Review, paying, filing a claim. The jury could limit the right to file a claim under 7437, but I think consistent with everything the court has said back from Norville v. Rice up for 150 years since then, the legislature could not take away the fundamental right to a jury trial. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon. Mr. Michella, Vincent D. Michella, representing the City of Milwaukee. Mr. Michella.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Again, my name is Vince Michella. I'm a Deputy City Attorney. I'm here on behalf of City Attorney Grant Langley, representing the City of Milwaukee today. And I would like to thank you for having us back to elaborate upon the jury trial issue that was of such great concern to you the first time we were here on April 12th, because I do believe it really made a difference in the analysis of this case, particularly from the city's viewpoint. At that time, I believe I stated in response to a question from one of you that there wasn't a lot of case law out there. And that, of course, leads all thinking lawyers to say, why not? And with the opportunity I had, when you gave us the chance to brief that issue, went back to the Marquette Library and found that rather amazing statute from 1849, which again, the 1849 statutes being the collation of the law up to that time from the years as a territory, and seeing that all that one had to do if one was not happy with the assessor was swear an oath. And if you look at that section carefully, you'll see upon penalty of perjury that the assessor was required to accept that. A bit surprising, but and it didn't last very long, so it may not have worked very well. You saw already by 1858 they were changing it. By 1868, we now have the genesis of the version that we are dealing with here today. So with that out there, there could not have been a cause of action in 1848 or 49 for excessive assessment, because all you had to do was say, I so swear. And I think the Ward case that we cited stands for that, Ward versus Delavan. And I'd like to address some of the points, because the petitioner relies quite heavily upon the Matheson case, and point out why, if you really take this down to a comparison of what was really the law, was it Matheson or was it the Ward case? Was this a mandamus action, or is there something else out there? When you read the Matheson case very carefully, you'll see it involves the statute that was in place at that time in regard to the affidavit. And you'll see that there's no mention of a jury trial in that case, and there's no mention of the Board of Review. Well, the Board of Review didn't exist until 1865.
Until 1868?
I'm sorry, 1868, excuse me, yes, correct. It did not exist in 1865. It was created by the statutes in 1868. So what you're dealing with here is an appeal from an administrative body. They didn't have an administrative body in 1848 or 49. You now have the Board of Review, and in between for 10 years from 58 to 68, you had the Board of Equalizers, which I believe was the town board, elected, I might add, which is something of a check, one would think, upon taxes getting too high in the old days. So when you look at that, Matheson, I don't think, stands for anything close to the kind of valuation contest that's contemplated by the current statute. Just it's not there. And I guess I would like to, really, and perhaps I should have started with it, but again, we're being asked, or you're being asked, and I'm being asked to defend, the petitioner's asking you to declare a statute unconstitutional. So we should start with the burden of proof. And as we recall from Nankin, you've said beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that applies here, too. They have to show that that jury trial right that they claim exists existed beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think as you go through the cases that they cited, and everything kind of, that they've cited kind of builds on the Matheson case. You got that in 65, you got the one from 1898, you got one from 1908, but there's nothing that says jury. And again, to answer the question that I think we all left hanging last time, why? Because you didn't need it. It didn't exist. And again, if you look at that other line of cases, they involve the illegal taxes, illegal actions. Again, think about what we're talking about here, which is a contest over what is that property worth.
So in answer to your own rhetorical question,
yes,
there's no mention of the jury, and then you said why, and then you answered your question, you said because they didn't need it. I'd like you to fill that in a little bit more. Why, in your estimation, was it not necessary?
Thank you, Your Honor. Because the oath intervened. I mean, the rule of village food says...
Didn't the oath, though, that process ended, as you mentioned, in 1858, lasted 10 years?
From 48 to 58,
right.
Correct. Yes. So at that point in time, and then you had it, it became a little more modified. It looked like, from what we can call from the somewhat archaic language of the statute and the cases, that you could make an oath after the fact, but it wasn't as determinative in the second 10-year period as it was in the first 10-year period. But the first 10-year period is the one that counts because of that was at the time the Constitution was formed.
Now, well, and in a valuation case, if you're going to have a jury, the jury's going to find a fact, and the fact is going to be what's the property worth. And if they're required to follow the law, which the trial court will instruct them to do, they're going to have to say the property is what the owner has averred that it's worth, right? There isn't a fact for them to find once they're instructed on the law.
Well, that's the point. There isn't a fact. There's nothing for a jury to do. Mm-hmm. If the law is that you have to accept the affidavit, why do you need a jury? And I was going to refer to Village Foods where it says a cause of action that existed. And I'd like to take you to the front end of that. What's the wrong? You need a cause of action. What would the wrong be that was done if, upon the oath, the assessor had to accept it? So there's nothing to sue on other than bring the mandamus. Now, the 1865 case, which is pretty thin, I think it's hard to tell, but there's enough of a distinction there that I don't think that case satisfies the lack of reasonable doubt standard, or for our students here, the irrefutable video evidence of that's the way it was. They can't get over that hurdle. And, you know, so it's a generic, what they have is a generic cause of action for money had and received. There was no, under the law of the state, there was no contest for value. In fact, you know, another point I want to make. In the 1868 statute, I think it's quoted on page 6 of our brief, when you talk about what the cause would be, that second section there, I think it's section, whatever it is on that page, is the first appearance of the definition of fair market value that looks like what we're dealing with here in the 21st century and dealt with in the latter part of the 19th and 20th centuries. So there wasn't a definition on the books at that time. So when you're talking about what's the contest, if you don't even have a similar definition, yeah, sure, it's what's it worth, but fair market value now has, in your cases certainly, a very definite meaning. Willing buyer, willing seller, no compulsion, all those things that are listed many times over in the various cases. So that wasn't there either in that critical period, 48 to 58. So there couldn't have been cause of action when you don't even have the same definition. And that really goes to the counterpart issue. No counterpart.
The cause of action money had and received existed at the time of statehood.
Yes.
And that cause of action carried with it the right to trial by jury.
The cases cited to you, I don't know that there is a Wisconsin case pre-1848 that says right to trial by jury in that. There are cases from other jurisdictions. There are Wisconsin cases that in the later part of the 19th century that say that. So again, and that was one of my next points, on the proof level, well, you know, yeah, as reasonable people you can say here, yeah, probably did. But did that apply here when all you had to do was take the oath under pain of perjury, which I think was taken a lot more seriously at that time? Historically, remember, what were we in? It was the period that was the end of the Second Great Awakening, one of those periodic religious revivals that we have where that really meant something, that old.
If a cause of action existed, money had and received, and you want to get all or part of that money back, is it your position that it's simply, it doesn't apply to a certain kind of money, like excessive taxes? Is that, I mean, what?
Thank you for that question, because I think it helps to focus the point I want to make. The distinction is that that action was for everything that was illegal, not the contest purely over value that we have here today under the new 7437 that we've had under the old 7437 since 1953. There's a distinction between taxing property that's exempt, taxing property that belongs to somebody else. Sure, you can bring that action, you can get a jury. But the state, prior to statehood, prior to the Constitution, said, if it's only a dispute about value, first we're going to try this affidavit thing, then we try the modified affidavit, and finally we get to the new system with the Board of Review where you have, in those days, I think you had some of the town board members, the assessor, I think it was the town clerk comprised the board. Now the statutes have been modified. You get some citizens. It depends on the jurisdiction. There is some local leeway allowed in that. So the answer is, yeah, there's that cause of action's there. In all likelihood, you did get a jury, but it's for this other genre of cases, not for what we're talking about here today. There was also a question that you asked my friend, Mr. Gould.
Let me ask this. You talked about if a tax was imposed and paid, and the argument is this was an illegal tax, not, as opposed to an excessive tax, would you get a jury then?
Yes. Different cause. And only because the state, in that pre-statehood period, intervened, an intervening superseding cause, perhaps, with that statute that said, so swear and you're done. There was nothing to sue on for value.
Well, and also, would it be your position that the holding in Matheson is closely related to the others that you listed out in terms of exempt property and the like? Because the holding in Matheson and was that there was no power. There was no power for the Board of Adjustment to have increased the tax because of the requirement of acceptance of the affidavit. And because there was no power, this court held that its actions were not illegal but unlawful.
Choice of words, but I think the same.
I would tend to agree with you.
So your position is that your opposing counsel on behalf of Metropolitan has failed to show that the common law money had and received existed for purposes of excessive tax assessment prior to 1848.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Whose burden is it to show that?
Oh, definitely the petitioner. And again, is where I was before. They're asking that you declare the new Act 86, which created the new version of 7437 unconstitutional. They have the burden, paragraph 10 of Nankin, beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that's what applies here. I think they have to make some fairly conclusive proof of this jury trial right, and I don't think that what you've heard or read from the petitioner's side meets that standard.
And that would be beyond a reasonable doubt, too, because if you say
yes,
there's a jury trial, then you're knocking out these statutes, so
yes,
you're back into constitutionality.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
I think the chief asked some question about income taxes and sales taxes, and they didn't exist back then. Was there any other kind of tax that existed in 1848 other than a property tax?
I don't know the answer to that. I would agree with you, certainly wasn't an income or a sales tax. There may have been local taxes. The functional equivalent, perhaps transportation taxes, if you cross the river you had to pay the state something as well as the ferry keeper, that sort of thing.
May have been occupation taxes.
Occupation taxes.
Maybe. I don't know that.
Excuse me?
I said, I don't know that, but if I had to make a guess, I would look under occupation.
And Your Honor, to address also one of the questions that you asked my friend, Mr. Gordon, in regard to other taxes, I think it's the city's belief that 70.85 sub 4C would be unconstitutional. That's the one that provides for certiorari review of a decision of the Tax Appeals Commission. And I don't know that you can really parse a distinction between, I mean, it's parallel. It's a certiorari appeal after a hearing by an administrative board. Just as here you have the Board of Review. And so if you analogize them, I think now we're going down the road of that's going to fall too. I mean, that would be a concern that I think needs to be addressed. And Mr.
The
Gordon,
taxpayer
I
makes
to
the choice.
That.
If the taxpayer makes a choice, waives the jury trial in effect by going to the administrative agency, no problem.
Well, I think they have,
you may have to have some procedures to advise them of their right, et cetera.
So, to conclude, I think that when you measure up what the law was, apply the right standard or burden of proof, that what you've heard doesn't quite get there. Given that, we would ask that you uphold Act 86. And I would like to suggest that we think that other than footnote 9, which I believe you asked about last time in the Court of Appeals decision, that the Court of Appeals, Judge Fine, did a very fine job of pointing out why Act 86 is constitutional up to the jury question. And then I think today, we've been able to demonstrate that the petitioner hasn't met the burden. And so perhaps somewhat similar to where the court was in the Noah's Ark case, this might be one where you might want to consider affirming the Court of Appeals decision as far as it goes and then perhaps discussing this question here today about jury trials in some more detail. With that,
are there any other questions for Mr. Michella? Hearing none, thank you very much for your argument today, counsel. Mr. Gordon.
First of all, just to answer Justice Prosser's question, we did cite a case on page 5 of our first supplemental brief called Jones v. Parrish, where there was a jury trial under the right to money hadn't received claim in 1845 before statehood. I think that we are almost being hoist on an involuntary petard here by the fact that the modern claim that I started at the beginning saying, the modern claim is so close to the common law cause of action that it's easier than the Court's other cases, but I think that's now come back almost to bite us, and here's why. In the earlier cases that this Court has decided under Village Food, there was no essential similar action in Wisconsin, and so the Court looked to English history and et cetera, to find English common law claims that were in some cases held to be analogous. Here, I think we should not lose sight of the fact that we're talking about the common law cause of action generally. We have been able to provide the Court with one, an exhaustively researched and documented law review treatise, about 100 to 150 pages, that goes through this exact issue and concludes beyond any question based on a very thorough history of English common law, American early common law, early U.S. Supreme Court cases before our statehood, that there definitely was, both under English common law and American common law, a right to file an excessive, as distinguished from an illegal, tax claim under the doctrine of money hadn't received and to get a jury in that claim. Three appellate courts have also considered this very issue that we've cited. The California Court of Appeal, now on appeal to the California Supreme Court, the Florida Supreme Court, and the United States Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit have is the California court especially went through that exhaustively, went through the English cases, went through the American cases, in almost the exact same situation, came to the conclusion also that the cause of action existed and allowed a jury trial for a tax refund in a suit against a tax collector under a common law right to for money had and received. In fact, in the California Court of Appeals, I think case is additionally relevant for one other point, because in that case, the California Franchise Tax Board, which is essentially in the role of the city here, made the exact same argument as the city is making here, claiming that the historic English and early American cases only involved illegal assessment cases as distinguished from excessive assessment cases. The California Court of Appeal analyzed all of the common law decisions. There are many of them, many old English cases, many old American Supreme Court cases. They analyzed that in detail with that exact question in mind, and they concluded that the historic common law cases included excessive assessment cases as well as illegal assessment cases. In particular, the court cited the 1836 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Elliott versus Swartwout, which was an excessive assessment case, as additional evidence that, no, there's excessive assessment cases covered here, not just illegal assessment cases.
Counselor, could I redirect you just a little bit?
Sure.
I have just one question, which I asked opposing counsel. If at the time we are examining historically, the sworn statement of the property owner had to be conclusive as to value, and in any jury trial, the court's going to instruct the jury to follow the law. So if that was the law, what was it that a jury would be trying at that time in regard to valuation?
Well, I think in that case, I appreciate, and certainly hard, it's hard to argue, Justice Rogensack, with the way you frame the question. What would the jury do except to be, it's a directed verdict case, in essence, if there were
right,
such things
that's
in,
right. And
that's in
what's
those
bothering
cases.
Me about
and I understand
argument.
That, but once again, the basic rule of Article 1, Section 5 is that anything the legislature does after statehood can't change the right to a jury trial. So it's the clear situation is they can't do it directly. Obviously, if this court would hold that, and as it has in, since Village Food, that cause of action X contains the right to a jury trial, the legislature can't change. We all know that. And I think we're getting hung up too much here, and I think we're going toward making too much of that early statute, because the serendipity of the fact that an early legislature, sometime after 1848, decided, okay, we will now have this special, you know, you go in, you swear, and you're done. That serendipitous act can't take away the right to a jury trial. It would be no different, I think, Justice Rogensack, than if the legislature, after, at some point, let's say in 1852, they discovered oil under the ground in Madison, and so there were no property taxes anymore. And they repealed the property tax and then 50 years later reinstated it. Well, the fact that the legislator had done that, and the fact that maybe in 1855 there had been a case where someone were assessed and were able to go in and get the instant relief, is serendipitous. But once again, it doesn't change the fact that before that statute was ever passed, after 1848, there was a common law right to a jury trial that under Old English and American common law, as well as in Wisconsin, allowed that cause of action to be used for excessive assessments.
Okay, so what you're saying is the statute that opposing counsel relies on was in derogation of the common law in regard to the right to jury trial?
I think it's academic because no property owner would have challenged that, obviously, if what they say goes. It's not that the statute was passed in derogation of the jury trial right, but the fact that the statute existed for a period of time at the time when Matheson was decided doesn't mean that there was no right to an excessive assessment action under common law. The legislature is derogating implicitly and maybe at a second or third level. Is taking away the excessive assessment claim, and so no jury would be necessary effectively. But effectively, that can't take away the larger global conclusion, which I think the court must reach, that based on the, you know, the treatise and the other cases and, the, and our Revolution of Wisconsin law, the serendipitous fact that they passed that statute for some period and said, you're not going to ever have to bring one of these cases, does not mean that under the common law cause of action at the instant of statehood that existed. And I think the trilogy of these courts' cases, Matheson and Stange and Associated Hospital, makes that clear all the way up to the present.
Thank you.
My red light is on. Justice Abrahamson.
Thank you, Mr. Gordon.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Gordon. I want to thank, on behalf of the court, both Mr. Gordon and Mr. Moschella for their arguments today. This is the second time we've had oral arguments. I've now gotten into the precedent of putting you on as the last oral argument of the day, but perhaps we won't have to do that another time, but we shall see. That ends our hearing on 09-AP-524, Metropolitan Associates versus City of Milwaukee. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:10. Yesterday. So we are adjourned for the October sitting of oral arguments.